Naturally Speaking.
Hi, and welcome to Naturally Speaking, the podcast of the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine. I'm James Bergen.
And I'm Karen Hotop. Today, we're concluding our special three-part series that we call...
Masters of Science.
And Research! In this episode, we're focusing on the final master's course, the MRes in Ecology and Environmental Biology.
But wait, is that it? That sounds far too short for this institute.
It is a bit of a change in style, so we can shorten it to MRes to keep with tradition. This program is actually quite near and dear to me, as it's the program that I recently graduated from.
Now, we did say this is the concluding episode in a three-part series, so make sure you've listened to the first two. These episodes are on the quantitative and welfare courses, the two top masters, and cover a lot of material shared by the three programs.
But back to the MRes! Despite the overlap, the MRes is the most divergent of the three masters, with more focus on the practical aspects of research and less time in the classroom.
But how different is it really? We caught up with senior lecturer Dr. Dominic McCafferty, who coordinates the MRes with Dr. Heather Ferguson, to find out.
The Master of Research, or the MRes, is a one-year full-time programme. It's distinctive from a traditional MSc programme in that it provides students with the opportunity of undertaking individual research projects, two research projects actually, in comparison to the normal one research project that an MSc student would undertake.
This increased focus on research, as opposed to teaching, gives students the power to invest their full effort into developing each of their projects.
The amount of independent study and research time that you can devote to carrying out a scientific investigation, really of your own choice, and develop some of your ideas of your own research, can really be taken forward over those two projects.
But before we zone in too much on the unique aspects of the MRes, we did say there was overlap with the top courses. So when does this occur?
The balance of taught and individual projects is split between a third of it is on the top courses, and I think you still really need to undertake some of the key research skills courses that underpin all research work. So even if you haven't, or if you've done some research before, then it can still be very useful in those top programmes, giving you the necessary statistical and literature search skills that you need for a research project. But then you can really build on that and spend a lot of your time pursuing your own interests in a particular field.
After finishing the key research skills, MRes students get to choose two taught modules from the diverse topics offered to the quantitative students. But then they are finished with the classroom, and the focus is completely on the research projects. So then, what is the advantage to two projects as opposed to one?
A really nice feature of having the two research projects is that it gives you an experience of, it could be a laboratory or it could be a desk-based modelling project or data analysis project. And then you can combine that with a field study, either here in Scotland or further afield, go abroad. So for example, this year we had a project being undertaken in the rainforest in Peru, right in the heart of quite a remote area in the rainforest. So there are great opportunities, great scope for developing your own projects, either here in Scotland or further afield.
We've kind of laboured the importance of there being two research projects, so we should probably discuss in more detail how they work.
The way in which research projects are developed or chosen is that at the start of the year you'd be given a range of titles. You'd also be given the names of research active staff in the teaching staff in the institute. So you would go away and spend some time looking at either projects or members of staff that are in a research area that you'd be interested in. You then meet with your potential supervisor and discuss the opportunities that there might be to undertake either a piece of work which they're interested in or that might align more closely with your own interests. So there is a great amount of choice given to the student in being able to pursue their own interests.
While students work closely with their supervisors, they're given a lot of independence over their own research. However, the course coordinators are always nearby to make sure things are running smoothly and that students are getting the support they need.
What we do is, over the course of the month, we would just ensure that the student and the supervisor is working closely together and be able to sort of really fully take part in the research community as well as having your own supervisor.
And what is it we are hoping students would gain from this course?
You would get research experience, but you would actually gain the necessary skills that you could undertake research independently. Either if you're thinking of moving towards further postgraduate study for a PhD, or if you're looking for work in a research environment.
And the university offers a diverse range of facilities to help students achieve their research goals.
There's a couple of other really good features also of the Institute that you can make the most of. Facilities such as the Field Station, the Scottish Centre for Ecology and the Natural Environment on Loch Lomond side, which is our first national park in Scotland. We're only 1 hour away from this unique field centre and you can actually live and work there and do your projects. We've also got University Farms if you're interested in maybe applied studies in managed animals. You can undertake work there, as well as a whole range of facilities in here in the Graham Kerr building and up in the vet school. Great laboratory facilities and aquaria that you can work in and do your projects. A great place to live and work, I'd say.
Of course, students are not just here to work. They're joining a welcoming and supportive community that they are actively encouraged to become involved with.
One of the great opportunities that you have of doing a master's here in Glasgow is the ability to mix with your academic staff much more closely than you would have done if you were doing your undergraduate degree, and mix with a whole range of research active staff, whether they be on the teaching staff or research fellows. There's a very good interaction both academically and socially as well. So I think you really feel that you've got an academic home here in the Institute.
Now, we wanted to see how these diverse opportunities actually played out with the students. So, like previously, we asked them.
When Ian Hill started talking to Dr. John Barnes after an Institute seminar, he probably didn't realise he had just started his first project.
My first project was actually with Dr. John Barnes and was actually looking at two species of tree frogs and the biomechanics of how they climb. Now, the tree frogs have been studied quite a lot climbing on flat surfaces, but John was interested in pursuing the angle of actually looking to see how they actually cope climbing curved surfaces. So what we did was devise a series of experiments where we actually took substrates of decreasing diameter, but also combined that with a catwalking technology where basically illuminated perspex shows the contact area. So I adapted that and made a series of see-through perspex tubing with LED arrays top and bottom. And we ran two species of tree frog, Latoria cerulea, a white tree frog, and Osteopilus septentrionalis, Cuban tree frogs.
It sounds like Ian had a very complex experimental design, not least because he had to deal with the frustrations that can come with working with live animals. So how did he fare with his frogs?
They very obligingly climbed for us a number of times up these tubes, and from that we were able to get rates of ascent, but also by finding a surface that they didn't adhere to well, we were able to eliminate capillarity.
Now, you might be wondering about this capillarity thing. Tree frogs have a complex system for climbing and sticking to surfaces. Dr. Barnes has done a lot of work on the mechanics of climbing in tree frogs, focusing mainly on a process called wet adhesion. In simple terms, this involves a fine layer of liquid between their large toe pads and the substrate they are climbing on, but it also involves many fine-scale morphological structures. However, wet adhesion is not the only force at play, and Ian and Dr. Barnes were interested in looking at the effect of some of these other processes, such as friction. So what did he find?
By eliminating their ability to wet adhere, we were actually able to show that they're still able to climb if the diameter is small enough. So in addition to capillarity, they also appear to use friction forces to climb. And that was, luckily enough, that led to me presenting that at the SEB conference in Prague this last year, which is a fantastic opportunity.
Ian then continued working with amphibians for his second project, but teamed up with Professor Roger Downey and Dr. Silvia Petrovano of Froglife to get out of the lab and into the field.
The second project was actually looking at amphibian road crossing tunnels. They are often put in as mitigation measures, compulsory by development, but they're not actually very well monitored. There's an exceptional high amount of site fidelity in amphibians, and some species take 4 years to adapt to a new route.
Ian chose to focus on a site containing a great diversity of species.
Common toads, common frogs, palmate newts and smooth newts.
This area is particularly good for these species as it combines both marshy foraging lands and a loch used for breeding. However, in 2004, a road was constructed separating the two, potentially impacting their ability to migrate without severe losses through car strikes. As a mitigation, three tunnels were installed under the road, but with no monitoring of the site since 2002, there was no way of knowing how effective they were. Ian wanted to see if the animals had adapted to using the tunnels. So how did he monitor them?
It involved the installment of some rather nicely built custom equipment that was built by Frank Clark for Frog Life. And I installed camera frames into the three tunnels and then installed cameras, and they take a picture every 10 seconds. And that monitored data for 60 days to monitor the migrations. And basically, I've made assessments.
And with 2,514 individual interactions over 60 days, Ian assured us he would be busy for quite some time figuring out what all this data shows. However, he did leave us with a very reassuring observation.
Amphibian decline is a well-recognised phenomenon now, and it's something that's causing a lot of concern globally. So it was lovely to be able to contribute in any small way to provide a greater understanding for what the mechanisms behind sustainability and where, and to actually find out that the populations on site still apparently doing very well there is very encouraging.
Ian clearly got to work on some fantastic projects. What would he say to someone looking at the EMRES?
So I've worked with great people and I've contributed to work that I'm proud of and feel very privileged to have been involved in. If there's any advice I give to anybody who was taking the courses, the masters, is to hit the ground running. I was so excited to have been back here, but it's so important in the sense to get involved, speak to people, attend all the additional lectures, because that's how I ended up on my first project. And people do fascinating work and you don't know where there'll be crossovers or opportunities.
While Ian did an undergraduate degree in zoology, he has been working in medical labs for the past few years. It seems that finishing this programme has reignited his passion for applied ecological research, and we look forward to hearing about what he goes on to do. The second EMRES student we spoke to showed that same enthusiasm for both ecology and the University of Glasgow.
I did my undergraduate at Glasgow. When I was looking at going back into a master's degree, I always would kind of centred back towards Glasgow. It's such a great university to come to. But I did look at other programmes, but none of them really gave me what I wanted to get from a master's degree. I think a lot of master's degree, they kind of really centre around that taught aspect of it. But what I preferentially wanted was that option of being able to go out and collect more data and do more research. And I didn't really see another programme that gave me that opportunity.
Alison jumped straight on this opportunity to get out in the field for her first project, which she tailored around her interests and goals.
My first project was an ecological-based project in the River Endrick, looking at the distribution change of a species of leech called Epibdella.
Alison has a deep interest in freshwater ecology and wanted to look at how climate change may impact the distributions of aquatic invertebrates. The small leeches she focused on have a well-known historic range on the River Endrick, but over the last 50 years, they've undergone a significant shift upstream. Alison wanted to know if this was simply an expansion of range or if it was associated with any significant changes in their ecology. To do this, she collected leeches along the length of the river, recording information including body size, local abundance, and microhabitat.
Alison found significant differences between the populations. In their original range, body size and local abundance were not related, even though they were more prone to congregating. Whereas in the new areas, the greater the number of individuals, the smaller they tended to be. They also showed significant differences in their microhabitat preferences in relation to both substrate and water depth. All in, this project gave Alison great experience and skills, which she aims to put to good use.
I'm looking to get into ecology, so I really, really enjoyed my first project. It was great. I really thoroughly enjoyed it.
Students are encouraged to pick a second project that will expose them to new skills, but it can be quite tempting to stay within a field you love, making a difficult decision for some.
In talks with Dominic, I'd suggested that my second project, I might like to do another field-based project. But I think it probably came down to it was, I've got all this available to me, I've got all this, these labs, I've got all these great researchers, great workers, and I took the opportunity to work on a lab-based project with Sean Killen, which I think was probably the better decision for myself, because now I've got that experience of both doing a field-based project and a lab-based project.
While she moved from the field to the lab, Alison, like Ian, chose to stay in a similar field, sticking with freshwater ecology by
looking at the inter-shoal mixing of the European minnow.
So, what happens when two shoals meet? Do individuals interact freely with unknown fish, or do they stick close to members of their original group? Shoaling is important in avoiding predation, finding reproductive partners, and increasing foraging success. So this is far from a trivial question.
In a series of mixing trials conducted in the Institute Aquaria, Allison found that minnows grouped according to size, regardless of which shoal they originally came from. This gives strong evidence for size-selective sorting and little to no shoal fidelity. She discovered this by using an up-and-coming mathematical technique for examining social structures in wild animals.
I was looking at social network analysis, so I've used all this new data analysis software called NetDraw that I've never even heard of before I started this project.
Alison's choice to move into the lab has really paid off for her too.
So it's been great, it's been really interesting, some really cool findings on both of my projects. Hopefully both of them have got some publishable work in there as well, which is really cool.
Despite an initial hesitation, she's now fully embraced the diversity of project types.
I've now got this huge kind of skill set that I couldn't even have thought of having at the start of the year. So yeah, definitely doing one field-based, one lab-based. I think the rest of the MRS guys will tell you probably the same thing as well, that having an experience of both was excellent. It was absolutely invaluable.
Well, that's the recommendation. If a student hits upon a great system the first time around, they can use their second project to investigate the questions raised by their first. And that is exactly what Tiffany Armstrong did when she started working with Dr. Kevin Parsons.
My first project, I looked at maternal effects in African cichlids, and I wanted to see if there was behavioral differences between individuals that were reared naturally by the mom in the mouth, or if they were different from the ones that I raised in an artificial container. I did that by exposing them to a novel environment and then two different types of startles. And I looked at the time spent freezing versus the time spent swimming around exploring the environment.
And so, fascinated with the results of this, Tiffany took the unusual step of continuing with the same supervisor in order to explore cichlid behavior even more.
Kevin and I worked so well together, and I was like, well, you know, I really like this project. I've worked really well with Kevin. I thought, might as well, if I can continue it, because all these questions came up, and I was like, well, I want to look at this. Like, I really want to see how they react in groups, so yeah. Can I do that? So
what exactly did Tiffany focus on in her second project?
So for the second project, I took the information that I got in the first one, where I found that individuals that were raised by the mom were bolder and had more anti-predator responses than the ones that were raised artificially. And I wanted to see if that changed when I exposed them as a group to the same stimulus that I exposed them to in the first one. And what we ended up going ahead and looking at was shoal cohesion.
Many fish will respond to a threat, such as a predator, by forming a tight shoal. The tighter the shoal, the more effectively this cohesion will act as an anti-predator defence. Tiffany found that those cichlids raised with their mother showed greater shoal cohesion than those reared separately. However, perhaps the most surprising thing is how novel this research is.
There's never been any study on maternal effects and shoal cohesion in fish. And there's not really been a lot on the maternal effects of the mouth brooding behaviour.
Maternal effects, in this case, the influence of the rearing environment on the offspring, is a hot topic in developmental biology. But it can be difficult to study in mammals because of our closed reproductive systems.
But the interesting thing with the mouth brooding of the fish is it's an internal environment and everything stays consistent within the mouth of the fish. And they're developing super close to each other and on top of each other, but you can take eggs away and develop them outside of it and they will still develop. So you can kind of see how the internal environment of the mom affects the development of the fish.
It's important not to underestimate the influence of these maternal effects. Trying to replicate the environment is no simple task.
We weren't looking for it or expecting it, but when you take them away from the mom, they develop slower, even though they're developing in the exact same temperature of a tank, the exact same water quality, the exact same lighting exposure. They develop slower than the ones that are reared by the mom. They were still in larval stages when the same exact genetic makeup of the fish was already, their partner groups were already free swimming and like fully developed. They were still in like larval stages with a full egg yolk present and everything.
While sticking with the same supervisor may not be the advised route, Tiffany is a clear example that in some cases it can be highly advantageous.
I haven't had this much chance to do this much research before, and I've never done so much stats in my life. It's been probably one of the best choices I've made so far with my like career path is to do this program.
Tiffany actually enjoyed her master's research so much that she remained with us and used her MRes as the basis for a PhD with Dr. Parsons.
Our final student, like Tiffany, also looked at shoaling behavior in his first project, but in a very different context. Christopher Convery looked at fisheries-induced evolution with Dr. Sean Killen. This is where commercial fishing is directly influencing the evolution of wild fish stocks. However, most research in this area has focused on the effect of fisheries-induced evolution on individual fish, neglecting to take account of the fact that most of the targeted species are shoaling, which means they undertake a form of collective decision-making.
To look at this, Chris set up a series of experiments in the lab to replicate a commercial fishing method called pot fishing, using common minnows as a substitute for their more economically important cousins. He found that those individuals who are most catchable when alone significantly increased the chances of the whole group being captured when allowed to shoal. This means that the presence or absence of a few key individuals can make all the difference. This could directly affect fish evolution, as shoaling is, as you'll remember, thought to have evolved as an anti-predator defence. But with humans, this no longer seems to be an effective survival strategy.
This work took place in the Institute's aquaria, which, if you don't know, are found in the basement. However, Chris went somewhere far more exotic for his second project.
I did it in Peru with the Cruz Foundation, So I went away for 2 months to the Manu region of Peru. It was brilliant. They've got a lot of really good work out there, so they have. But yeah, first time in Peru.
Peru, and the Manu region in particular, is a biodiversity hotspot. This means that there is a staggering wealth of potential projects. So what did Chris decide to study during this amazing research experience?
Yeah, what I was trying to do was look at passive acoustic monitoring and see, is this here a new method that we can actually calculate river quality from? So kind of the concept is that we're going to, instead of collecting the insects, which is the normal way of measuring river quality, if we can pick up the sounds that the insect makes, then this is a way of bypassing that. So that's the concept.
Unfortunately, Chris's results didn't show quite what he was hoping for.
Well, it found that the acoustic monitoring wasn't a reliable method for predicting river quality.
But, like all good field biologists, Chris was looking at more than one thing.
I also had a second aim, which was looking at how river quality changes between the different forest types that they have there in Cruz. So what we found for that was that the regenerating forest, it's actually really healthy, so it is, even though that the land has been completely cleared for like cattle ranching and logging, and it can actually recover, so it can, to the primary status.
However, the story wasn't quite as rosy for the river Chris focused most heavily on.
The River 4, which my project, Salvacion, it was the jungle town, so it's the current human-mediated disturbance. It was actually really poor quality, but that was kind of because it was expected. A lot of people use that as their like main resource in the area. And like I visually observed a lot of people washing cars in it, and I found soap and rubbish and stuff in it too. So I found out that the rainforest can recover, and it can recover very quickly.
From the depths of the basement aquaria to the jungles of Peru, Chris's experience exemplifies the range of possibilities available with this program. And unsurprisingly, he gave it a glowing review.
I thought the MRS was brilliant. It's just a really good course, and you feel like part of the Institute as well whenever you do the MRes here. I think that's kind of important as well, that you actually feel part of the university. And no, it's a good course and I'd recommend it.
And you know what, Chris? So would we. This brings to a close our special three-part series looking at the Institute's master's courses. In part one, we examined how to quantify life with the MSc in Quantitative Methods in Biodiversity, Conservation and Epidemiology.
In part two, we got ethical with a deep discussion of the MSc in Animal Welfare Science, Ethics, and Law.
And here, in part three, we have researched and reported on the MRes in Ecology and Environmental Biology.
Hopefully, this series has given you a taste of what's on offer should you decide to come study with us.
Arguably, the success of our three programs has been measured most poignantly in how many students choose to join us. This year, we have welcomed an incredible 60 students.
And if you are tempted to follow their lead, you can find out more about the courses and how to apply on the Institute website.
Just click on one of the many, many links accompanying this podcast on our original post.
While we could sum up why you should follow those links, we thought we would give that honour to Dr. Dominic McCafferty. He summed up the master's programmes perfectly.
Doing a master's here in Glasgow is a great opportunity for you to develop some great skills for your future scientific career. It's like all university courses, the more that you put into it, the more that you'll get out at the end of the day. And it's really fantastic to see students graduating after a year here at Glasgow, ready to take the next step forward in their own scientific careers. I hope you'll come to Glasgow and I hope you enjoy the course while you're here.
I'm James Bergen.
And I'm Karen Hotop.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at the NS Podcast, and you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.